You're on.
Well, Bill, are you there?
Yeah, but I can barely hear Greg.
Well,
that's okay.
It's your voice we need to hear right now. So good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Yeah, so, that's better.
Bill, what did you want to finish up from last week?
Yeah, I was thinking about talking about the moratorium that's been extended now for tenants and also the court, what's happening in terms of evictions in court. But I am actually traveling, so without my materials in front of me, I thought it might be better if we finished off the conversation that we started last week about riparian rights, water rights, particularly on inland lakes, since we have so many inland lakes and streams in Jackson County, that it might be worthwhile to finish off, well, continue that conversation. And one of the things, you know, if you have a pad of paper there, I'd like to talk a little bit about accretion and erosion and then sudden change in the location of a water course, which there are special laws that apply to those three things. And then I started talking about putting out docks from your property, and one of the myths that lakefront owners have is that they think that they take their property line, in other words, the property line itself on the dry land, and then when it hits the water, they think that they can simply, that their property extends as a simple extension of those lot lines, and that is absolutely false. That in fact, once, when you get to the point where your boundary line hits the water line, hits the shore, at that point, the boundary line is determined by two primary methods in the state of Michigan. One is the most prevalent, which is what's called the median line method or the center line method. For example, if I own property on a circular lake, let's assume it's a perfect circle, and I can locate a single point that is the center of that lake, then the bottom land of the lake that I would own, and again, this is only on a natural body of water. There's a whole different set of rules that applies to an artificially created body of water, a stream that's dammed, that becomes an artificial body of water. But on a natural body of water, if I can locate that center point, my boundary lines for my bottom lands go from where my boundary lines on dry land hit the lake and then go toward the center line, or to the center point. Let's suppose that it's an oblong shaped lake. We'll find that we can actually do a survey. We find what's called the median line of the lake, which is a straight line, finding just going from shore to shore, opposite shore to shore. I'm making it sound easier than it actually is from a survey point. But at any rate, and then what you do is you draw lines which are perpendicular to the median line, which then go to the boundary line at the shore. And surveyors can do this. Now, the interesting thing is that the surveyor's got to make a judgment as to what is the exact point on the other shore so he can determine or she can determine what that median line is. Then the other predominant method is what's called the proportionate method. And in a proportionate method, what a circuit court judge does is he takes what the total amount of shoreline is and versus what the percentage is that each person has of that shoreline, and then allocates out the bottom land on a proportional method where it's an odd-shaped lake and you can't do a median line. The other rule that applies is where there's a cove. In other words, if you look at Clark Lake, for example, I know there's at least one cove, and I think two coves on it, where there's a point that juts out and it curves around. Now, all of a sudden, in terms of determining a median line, it doesn't work on the cove. So now what I have to do is I have to have a point in the cove where we draw a line again from the point where the boundary lines hit the shore to that point in the cove. And I had mentioned last week about the case I had on Round Lake where it was on a cove, and if you extended the dock far enough, you would touch the other docks so that nobody would have riparian access. So that's one of the, I'm saying this in a sort of a simplistic fashion, but you can't automatically assume that where you think your bottom land is for placing your dock is where it is. It's not necessarily the case, and particularly on a cove. And at that point, as I mentioned, the DNR can come out and they'll try and resolve the dispute, but ultimately it's up to a circuit court judge if the parties can't agree. You got a question, do you?
I don't know. I'm not sure I was following you. So.
All right. Well, all right. Sorry about that. One of the other issues is whether there's public access to a particular lake or another body of water. And back in the 1800s, a Michigan Supreme Court decision established that navigability is determined by whether or not the body of water can float a commercial-sized log, because we were a logging state, very predominantly a logging state back in the early 1800s, mid-1800s, late 1800s. And so the court said if you can float one of these logs in that body of water, it's navigable. Now, that doesn't mean that an isolated lake, let's take Clark Lake, there's no way to get into Clark Lake, okay? There's no body of water, no stream, no river that connects it so that you can't get into it. The only reason that Clark Lake is a public body of water is because there's a public access. Once there's a public access to it, now all of a sudden the members of the public have the right to traverse the entire lake, to use it for recreational purposes, boating, fishing, water skiing, all of those things that are natural recreational aspects of a body of water. If you take the Grand River, for example, and the Grand River, for the most part, is, I think, navigable. There may be parts of it that are non-navigable. There was a decision about 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, in which the Court of Appeals attempted to change the definition of navigability from floating a log to the ability to put a canoe or a kayak in it. And, of course, it's much easier to float a kayak than it is to float a commercial-sized log. The Michigan Supreme Court reversed that Court of Appeals decision and said there's no reason why we should change the traditional definition of navigability, because so many people have bought property over the decades, over a century, relying upon the floating a log test. So we still maintain that as a definition of navigability. And you get all kinds of disputes about that. You and I, for example, we own the property on Skiff Lake. Skiff Lake is a private lake. There is no public access. The public doesn't have a right to get to it. Only the people who own property on Skiff Lake have right to access the lake. One of the issues for us became there's a small pond that is connected to Skiff Lake. Water flows out of that pond. The pond is spring-fed. The water from the pond goes into Skiff Lake.
Uh-oh.
Connection. It's simply a surface water. What?
Somebody bleaked out, so, but that's all right. Keep going. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
All right, somebody tried to access the pond from Skiff Lake, but you can't do it. There is surface water that goes across, but it's essentially a swamp. So you can't simply take a canoe or a kayak and go from Skiff Lake into the pond. So that particular stretch is non-navigable. Even the people who own property on Skiff Lake are unable to access the pond. There's also one other rule that applies in Michigan. It's called the dead-end lake rule. And if you own property at a dead-end lake, in other words, it's at the end of an otherwise navigable body of water, unless the members of the public have access to it, they don't have access to a dead-end lake, because it doesn't go anywhere. In other words, navigability, the concept of navigability, is based upon the fact that I'm getting from point A to point B, and I have to have a reason to go to point B. And on a dead-end lake where I don't own the property, there's been no historic public use of that particular part of the body of water, I can close it off. I mean, all of these rules with respect to water rights in the state of Michigan. Really quite complex, very difficult to understand, and you can't simply assume that you have certain rights. You may shut off those rights. The other thing is, as a private property owner, you may think you can shut off the rights of the public when in fact you cannot. And there are hundreds and hundreds of cases establishing what the rights of private property owners are. And I will also say that almost every case is different. They have to be decided on what's called an ad hoc or case-by-case basis. Another issue that arises, particularly on streams, not so much on lakes, but on streams, as a course of a stream changes over time, it may erode the bank on one side of the stream, and sand and silt will accrete on the other side. In Michigan, the law is that you are entitled to the land which accretes to you. In other words, your boundary line on that body of water will change as the shoreline changes, so that as it erodes over a gradual period of time, you will lose part of your dry land. On the other side of the river, if it's around a bend, for example, where it accretes at the bend, that property owner on the other side will gain land, will gain property as the boundary line changes, as the course of the stream or the river changes. I mentioned at the outset, now, a sudden change in the location of the course of a body of water, of a stream or a river, is called avulsion, A-V-U-L-S-I-O-N. And in that event, a sudden change does not change the boundaries. And that happens if there's a flood, earthquake, some other catastrophic event that changes the course of that river or stream. And in that case, the boundary line doesn't change, so that if the course of the river changes sufficiently so that your boundary no longer touches that stream or river, you just lost your riparian rights in and to that body of water.
So you're no longer waterfront.
You're no longer waterfront. One of the last things that I'll say is irrigation. You got to remember, and this is a huge issue out west of the Mississippi, where water rights are treated entirely differently. Here in Michigan and in most states east of the Mississippi, if I have a body of water and it obviously runs downstream, I'm entitled as a riparian owner to make reasonable use of the water in that water course. What I can't do is I can't take water from that water course and remove it from that particular stream or river's watershed. In other words, I can't take it and sell it. That's one of the big issues with Nestle and its water, you know, bottled water plants, trying to figure out what it can and can't do with respect to, it's not surface water that it's taking, it's subterranean water. Slightly different issue, but surface water, I can use it. If I'm a farmer along that body of water, I can use it to irrigate my farm, et cetera, but I can't remove that water from the watershed. I had a case over on the west side where my client was buying a very, very large tract of land, going to operate a dairy farm on it, and lo and behold, they find out that the current owner had gotten an easement from a riparian owner. The farm is non-riparian. It's not adjacent to the body of water, but they had gotten an easement from the landowner between the farm and the river, an easement. They put an irrigation, water line in, and pump to be able to irrigate. Can't do it. Completely prohibited. So I told my client, if you're going to buy this, you need to make certain that you have adequate subterranean wells to be able to provide water for irrigation, because you cannot. You cannot, as a non-right, you can as a riparian owner, sell or vend or convey that water to a non-riparian owner. And you can only make reasonable use of it, because the downstream owners are going to want to make use of that water as well.
Well, so as a farmer, I can't use the water. If there's a water body, I can't use it to irrigate, or I can use it to irrigate?
I can use it as long as I'm a riparian owner. What okay. I can't do is I can't use the water to irrigate non-riparian land or to do other things with it for non-riparian use.
Okay.
Okay? So one of the other issues that I'll raise with you is the lakes that are non-motorized or limited motor. You know, Crystal Lake, I think, down in Hillsdale County, North Hillsdale County. That lake is one of those where it's limited to, it's either non-motorized or limited to something like 5 horsepower, et cetera, for fishing. I've had on a private lake a client where another, they bought property and another property owner said, oh no, this is a non-motorized lake. What's the term I'm looking for here, Laura? I can't think of it. It's not.
Non-motorized is what we use.
Non-motors, but at any rate, another property.
You can have an electric motor, but you can't have a gas-powered motor.
But every other lake, if a property owner tells you that it's a non-motorized lake because they want it to be non-motorized, it's not a non-motorized lake unless all of the property owners or the original developer who owned all the properties surrounding that body of water said this is a restrictive covenant that binds every property owner on it. If you are on a body water and several of the property owners have gotten together, said we're not going to use motors on this, that doesn't bind you at all to that private restriction. It's got to be all or nothing in order to provide for an entirely non-motorized lake.
We had that happen on I had that happen with someone I knew on a smaller lake where one of the landowners told someone who was out there boating that it was a non-motorized lake when, in fact, that wasn't the case at all.
Yeah, we're thinking of the same case.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Right. Yeah, and that's just, you know, somebody trying to pull the wool over the eyes of another property owner.
Right. Well, one topic we should hit at one point is I've got one coming where I'm selling some vacant land and making sure that the vacant land has access to the county road. So with that said, we need to move on. It's time to end the show, except for I'm going to talk about what real estate I've got available. 3435 Carlton Boulevard has just reduced its price to $253,000. It's a great three-bedroom, two-bath home, a newer construction, two-car attached garage with a large pole barn. It's at the end of the road in Summit Township, so you feel like you're out in the middle of nowhere because it's heavily wooded. And there's some gravel road right there. We've got 624 St. Clair. It's got an offer on it, but if you want to do a backup offer, another three-bedroom, two-bath, main-floor laundry house with an oversized garage and a large backyard. That one's $184,900. Vacant land on Cooper Street, corner of Cooper and Porter, $100,000. Great visibility, and there's some growth going on Cooper Street, so now it's time to snatch that one up. And then I've got some coming up. I'm be listing a new one today, which is a three-bedroom, one-bath, first floor, bedroom and bathroom, full basement. It's on the northeast. It's in the northeast side of town. It'll be 1099, so if you want information on that. And then in about a month, I'm going to have a very beautiful high-end home on a one-of-a-kind street in the city of Jackson. It'll be in the $400,000 range. And then we've got two three-bedroom, one-bath, less than 1,000 square foot homes coming on the market soon. And one's in Summit Township and one's in Blackman Township. If you would like more information about anything that's on the market or I can help you get your home on the market, now's the time to sell. We have a huge shortage. I ran a search for someone the other day just in Jackson County, not including the city of Jackson, and there were only 93 houses on the market. Those are ones that don't have offers on them. So 93 in the county, excluding the city of Jackson. That's not very many. I'd love to help you. If you're thinking of buying or selling, you should be thinking real estate. Laura Dwyer-Schlechte, 517-780-3800.